Fred Bloody Copeman, Reel 10, hopefully.
Did you ever meet Hemingway?
I told you we had an up and down. I didn't know who the hell he was. Whose big fellow he was, you know. Had a bit of a beard then. He didn't have this long, fuzzy thing. He just looked as if he didn't have a shave. And he'd come up to the American section and they made a hell of a fuss of him, of course. We didn't know who the hell he was. Hemingway didn't mean anything to us, except that there had been an article in either New York Times or one of the big American papers by Hemingway, which gave an impression that the Battle of Coamo was, if it was won at all, was won by the Americans, which was a damn bloody lie. They didn't come into the thing until about a fortnight after the start, and then they went straight into a trench, and they ran out of that once. We had to clear it for them. So there wasn't any, my attitude when it was mentioned. Haldane, in one of the talks at night, said, well, of course, Fred, these Americans, out of all proportions, their ability, it is a country that uses propaganda, you know, well, and knows how to use it, whereas the English are a little bit amateur at it, certainly at our level. And sure enough, it turned up. I told you, we had a headquarters. You couldn't get near it. If you came within 100 yards of our headquarters, you had to pass someone. And you didn't get by. It didn't matter if you were the King of England, if you didn't have a pass or knew what you were about, or they knew who you were. You didn't get by. It was simple as that. And this bloke turned up, with Monaghan, by the way, the battalion commander. And the lad who stopped him was George Wright. Not George Bright, the cardinal who died. George Wright, who the fellow who acted the goat, got stripped and became a ghost to get back home. And George was that way, you know. He'd either just on the spur of the moment decide you're good looking so you can go by whoever you were, or he would dig in. He obviously decided this fellow looked important. He was going to get in the news. You're not getting by. And old Monaghan said, you know me. I said, yes, you know me, you can go, but not this fella. So there was a bit of a row, and I went up. Then there was Hemingway. Wow. Oh, I said, you come to the British battalion. What is it you want? Oh, he said he wanted a story. I said, you've already printed a bright bloody story, haven't you? I said, old Monaghan told you the truth about Coamo. He wasn't here. Oh. Anyway, one thing led to another. And he said he had a right to go through. I said, well, you're not going through this sector now. I've come to the conclusion you'll never do us any bloody good, so you can get the hell out of it. Well, he wouldn't get out of it. I said, well, I'll lock you up. Put the rifle, stuck it in the middle of his back. Get walking. Didn't know where we were going to take him. There was nowhere to take him. He kept walking. So they walked him down to Sam Wiles ammunition dump. I said, where's your car? He said, along the way. Well, one thing led to another, and I said, I'm going to take you right out of bloody Spain. You're one of these bumptious bastards, you know. The world thinks we're just going to tame you, old mate. So that's what we did. We stuck him in his car. With one of our blokes, he had it was a big car, and we had our big posh car. We drove him to Barcelona. He had a bit of an up and down of there. And I said, we'll drive you right to the bloody border and put you over the other side. It was one of these times at the crime where everybody had plenty of time, you know. It was exciting to do something. And our old car could get down there and back within a day and a half. So we took him down. Well, it didn't really do any good that he was back next day, but at least it put him off our sector. I don't think it did us any good. Obviously, we never got anything good out of Hemingway, and he was an important person when he came to propaganda. And Harry mentioned it. Next time old Harry Pollock came out, he said, what the hell have you done with Hemingway? He's spending his bloody time finding reasons why the British battalion are all wrong, you know, and the Yanks are all right. I told him the story, said, Fred, you'll never be a politician. said, you should have been nice to her. We'd have got some lovely articles in the Times, would have quoted, you know, from the New York leading paper like that. We'd get some publicity. Anyway, that's where it finished. We met him once and we had our trouble. We met Attlee and Ellen Wilkinson when they came out. I liked old Attlee. He was a little man physically, but he was quite a tough handful, you know, when it came to politics. And of course, Ellen Wilkinson was a real good one. Ellen had everything against her. If you could look for an ugly woman, it was Ellen. She was bandy-legged, she had red hair and funny little old face. Gentle, I thought, but she was a real lovely person, though. Really was. And we went up the front with Huey Gallagher. They turned up one day. This was going to be the great thing for the British. The leader of the opposition was coming out, so we put on all the stops. Met him down at Maratta, brought him up. Well, of course, by the time we got to the farmhouse, where there was bullets flying round. I mind they were expended bullets, but to him, that was, you know, he was in the war. And poor old Attlee got more and more scared. Well, everybody gets scared when they first go into line. And you hear bullets hitting trees, and now and again a shell flies over. You think, my God, I'm in trouble. But Ellen just jazzed up there as if nothing had happened. Anyway, Willie Gallagher, the Communist MP, said, look after Clem, Fred, it's important. So I kept old Clem, I said, and I talked to him all the way up. I said, of course you realise everybody's scared when they get here. You'd be here a week, you'll think you're in London, you take no notice, but don't worry, because you're frightened. I can see you're frightened, but just keep close to me. And only move where I move. Because there were people fixed. I told you, these fellows on the other side didn't waste any time. They would get to know what was happening, something special. They'd be looking out for anybody special. And old Attlee had his funny little old English army helmet, those silly flat things, you know, that had in the First World War. And Ellen just jazzed around with nothing, with her red hair flowing. And finally we got to the front, to the headquarters. And I took him right up the front. By this time, he was ready to die almost. Really was. It got him down, you know. I said, well, you know, stick it, because this means a lot. And he said, I am, but I'd like to get out of here. Anyway, he went along the line and went back again, and then we decided to have a real big do at night. We were going to have only one company left in the line, and we'd all go down to Maratta in the square, and everybody holding a torch, and he would do his stuff, and we were going to name the battalion the Major Attlee Battalion and get the press, you see. Well, he thought, well, all this bloody light, what about the bombs, you see? I said, they won't waste the bloody loons, can't get off the bloody ground at night, let alone find the front line, and they wouldn't come up there, they only bomb Madrid, you see, at Milo. And we had our big parade, and that was it. Many years afterwards, when I was doing my stuff in the Labour Party, old Attlee had a talk with me. He said, Fred, I've never forgotten. You were very good to me. And I'm certain it was old Attlee that got me the OBE, you know. Just as I wouldn't have it first. There was an argument on the principle. Then they offered the MBE, and I said, you get knotted. I'm not a bloody sergeant, you know. That's the sergeant awarded either something good or nothing at all. And then the next, that was with Churchill. And then the next year, they offered the OBE, and then I had a meeting with a party, and they said, oh, you ought to accept it. So I accepted it. It doesn't mean anything at all, except that it just means that somebody somewhere remembered, you see. And I think it was Attlee. That's the only way he could. I could have really gone places in the Labour Party, you know.
Who decided to name the battalion after Attlee? That sounds like a...
Well, I didn't agree with it. I said to Harry, look, no name is big enough. They won't have it. It'll die off. But if it's going to be helpful, do your stuff. So the party decided it was going to be the Major Attlee Battalion. Caused a hell of a row in Parliament, of course, that the official leader of the opposition went to Spain. Why it should, I don't know, because after all, he visited the official government. Franco rebelled. And of course, the Tories had the power, and they used the propaganda. But it did a lot of good. We had the old boy from Reynolds. He impressed me more than anybody else. All the people that came out. Nye Bevan and the crowd of Labour MPs came out. I liked Nye Bevan, but at that visit, it was too much of, you know, these important people. Well, we'd already had Attlee, so anybody below that couldn't possibly be that important. So you got rather dim treatment, which he didn't like. Nye liked, you know, to be good old Nye. And if you didn't give him that, you didn't get much change. To me, it was just a bloody nuisance. It came on a day when we had our trouble. There'd been a real row. Three blokes had gone to the British Embassy and gone back home. It was the only time it happened. And became real terrors, you know, everything was wrong. Really viciously attacked the brigade. And we were the only three right through, although plenty came home, but nobody did that. And there was a bit of a row. I want to know what the hell we could do. Every month we used to go with these lorries and pick them all up and bring them back. It'd always been a success. So why should you blame us? Other people would lose them, the Yanks especially, lost them by the dozen. And that was on at the time when this group with Nye Bevan came out. So I said, I'll meet you down at Valencia. No point in coming up the front. They wanted a picture taken. You get down the MP, he likes himself, you know, get me picture taken in the battle. Old Attlee never even questioned whether he had it. In fact, he was so quiet, he'd like to hide behind a wall, kind of. He's that type of fellow, you know. He didn't go for publicity in that way, although he got plenty. Who else came up? You know, I think Nehru. I could never get out of my mind that I met Nehru somewhere in Spain. He was visiting in and out. And yet, I'm not sure. It was an Indian anyway, and I'm certain it wasn't Nehru, but off the record. I was very impressed with that fella, anyway, whoever he was.
When you came back to Spain in 1937, that was before the Battle of Teruel.
Yeah.
Was the battalion engaged in training, as they had been before Brunetti?
Yeah. They were at Mondeca. But they were obviously in trouble. The numbers had gone down. There were so many things you could do in Spain to dodge the front. If you like to find yourself a little corner in a hospital or, you know, on somebody newspaper, or as long as you had an answer at the moment the fella said, what are you doing, you could stay there, you know, you had to have that knack. And once again, my attitude was, if a fellow was working in a hospital with English doctors, well, he's making a contribution. There's no reason why we should make a fuss. But I turned up with a second crowd and just dumped them and reported to the brigade headquarters and brigade commander, what was his name, the opera singer. Said, you'll have to stay on the brigade staff, but Jock Cunningham's gone and you're going to take his place. And you'll be in command of a sector, and the British battalion is involved with the Americans. That's your job. Well, I didn't last a week. I visited both the American and British battalion, had a talk with them. There was a new American commander, I forget his name, and Merriman, the top American, was on the brigade staff, who I was very impressed with, this fellow Merriman. University bloke, say. Nearly all their officers were top intellects, you know. Ours were the opposite.
He was killed, wasn't he?
He was killed with Wally Tapsell. I think they were liquidated. They were sorted out. There was an awful lot of viciousness going on towards the end because the brigade was getting less important because the European people couldn't get recruits. They were fascists, weren't they? Germany and Italy and places like all under fascist dictatorship. They couldn't get recruits. So they simply got smaller and smaller and less important politically. Whereas the party wanted the brigade to remain. That's why we took another lot out. But finally, the British party had to conform with the others to decide that was it. They certainly, by the end of TOL, we decided recruitment was off. It was a wrap-up. The League of Nations was already getting to the stage of the Russians agreeing.
Why would the Russians want to get rid of Tapsell and Mermaid?
Well, I can't say. Why did they get rid of all the commanders after the war? Everybody but the Spanish were liquidated in Russia by Stalin. Every general was bloody well shot. Even the Polish fella, got rid of him. They, for some reason, the Spanish Civil War is not what the Russians want to keep in history. As far as they're concerned, it was an incident, forget it, and liquidate anything to do with it. And this fight that was going on, you see, the brigade officers were ahead of everybody else. They had found out something. They had their teeth in something which was rotten, and they weren't bloody well letting go. And these incidents of insisting on the Russian commander of the division, Gahl, were quite out of this world. You don't have battalion commanders telling the divisional commander where he gets off, you know. It got to that stage, almost over the phone, saying, get stuffed. You know, we do it our way. And we took our machine gun company up and caused a bloody riot. But we got Tappy out. You see, the fact that Tappy was arrested by Gahl, then this incident, I went out, took over the battalion, and with this new crowd and all the good publicity had been given, it was easy to control them, easy to discipline them. They were now the majority. And they started off right away, saluting officers, marching properly and singing and proud to have lovely rifles and things, you know. So we had a new battalion again, up to 660, and good company commanders. And TOL was a good thing. It went off well. We took TOL. But I had been taken away the night before. We had our usual meeting with old Harry Pollitt before a big battle. Harry used to come out and have a talk and do his stuff. And halfway through the meeting, I got me monthly tummy ache. But it didn't go away. It got worse and worse. And finally, I couldn't bloody well talk. It was so damn painful. So they brought the doctor in. Oh. Straight in the hospital. No argument this time. You're going in. I used to argue with him every time he came before. He said the same thing. You've got an appendix. You can get it out. Anyway, this time he said, you must go in. You must go in at once. We're talking about hours. It'll be too late if you don't go in. So I was humped into an ambulance. Away I went. But before I went, I insisted on Sam Wilde being made the adjutant. So Sam was brought out of the ammunition dump and made adjutant, and Bill Alexander took over. And they did well, TOL. Bill got wounded very quickly early on, the first day, I think. Got one through here, pretty bad one.
Through the shoulder?
Under the shoulder, went through an artery, and it's a big thing. Of course, he was out, and Sam took over. Then, of course, the usual reaction, no ammunition, back we went, lost TOL. And from that moment onwards, we really never stopped going back. I mean, the end of the war was in sight. They had a few actions up on the Ebro, did well there. So remember, we by now had a minority of English in the battalion. And they got across the river and took Gandesa. The British were the first into Gandesa, you know. Didn't stay long. They're out again. And once I came out of Gandesa, well, that was the end. They went, retreated right back and were taken out. While this was happening, I was in hospital doing my stuff. dying every other day. Bloody hell. I look back on the time I lay in that damn bed. I had all the treatment of the world could give, the finest medical treatment. Two lovely nurses who really would do anything for me. And every so often I just emptied out. Bloody blood just poured out. And everybody gave it up. You know, I knew what was going on. Everybody was saying, oh, Fred's going to die, you know. What are we going to write about him? It didn't happen that way. I finished up down in Benicassim, and there I met Bill Alexander, who'd been there some few weeks. And then within a few weeks, we were all out. I went out first. Got the treatment, too. Came in a lovely ambulance carriage hooked on to some express that went right through France to Victoria. And turned up at Victoria. And then, of course, a few weeks after, the brigade came back and we met them at Victoria with quite a lot of top Labour people. One fellow who amazed me, who made a point of being there, was Stafford Cripps. And he hadn't taken much part. Very religious fellow, you know, Cripps was. Very religious. We had that huge meeting at the Emperor's Hall where some pretty fine actress, Vivian Leigh, and what's that fella's name who's still acting? Oh dear, Mum knows her name. They each read thing. The fella read the, you remember, I ran all this, you see, and I'm very English, and I'm not really a party bloke. I'm far too independent to be a good communist. And I believe in the basic principle, but not necessarily the method. And this was a wonderful show. The flags of every nation, none of this all red flag bloody business with me. My attitude was, if you're French, let's have a bloody French flag. And if you're German, let's have a German, you know, and do it right. And the Union Jack's got to be there, mate. Never mind about a red flag. So they all marched in with 60 or 70 different countries' flags, and it really was a good meeting, packed out to the roof. And these people, these artists, were giving something, you know. After all, it was a left-wing business. And then I just worked on with the International Brigade. Independence Fund and switched that over from a strict...
Was the fund run by Charlotte Holding?
You what? Yes, Charlotte ran it. Good woman Charlotte was, you know. Oh, she was a good... Mind you, you do in life see things that... Charlotte must have been, what, 45, 50? But she acted as if she was 16, you know. She would doll around that bloody house up in Regent's Park with castanets. She was getting a bit fat by now, you know, everything wobbled. And she had about half a dozen lads from the brigade living there. And I used to sit back. Well, on the one hand, there was the old boy, the professor, who had the chair at London University, biology, and whose biology was very practical when it came to good-looking girls, you know. He wasn't short of that. And on the other hand, here was Charlotte trying to look as nice as these lovely little students. The lads were quite delighted, of course. But I used to sit back, oh, Charlotte. Years afterwards, I met her again. I think it was after the war. She had this lad who wrote, I can never forget, remember the name. He wrote a book which became a film that, what do you call it? Taylor, Elizabeth Taylor starred in, so it must have been a good thing for money, wasn't it? And he suddenly got in the money. He was on dope. And I couldn't, Charlotte said, have a talk with him. I said, well, the fella's got beyond talking. Nobody would get him off of that by talking. And I spent a good time because I stayed with Charlotte Hornaday for a time after the war in her house up in Regent's Park. And curiously enough, at that time, the Thetis, a submarine, sank with a lot of dockyard mateys on, a full crew. And the skipper got saved. Only about three got saved. One of them was the skipper. And in the Navy, this is something, you know what I mean? After all, what the hell? And it caused a real uproar because everybody was drowned other than the... And they brought Haldane in to do an inquiry. Well, he fitted up, at the cost of the Admiralty, two rooms, one above the other, you know, as a submarine would be. It cost a lot of money, a lot of water involved, and used the brigade fellas. He had a very simple theory that these people who did get out and reach the top and they were dead had drowned themselves in the escape hatch, that they were sick. And they just drowned, and when they opened, they just floated to the top of the dead. Only the skipper, who happened to be in a part of the submarine which wasn't as foul in air as another, got away with it. The two other fellows. And it was such a simple theory, but it had to be proved. And of course he proved right. The problem was that they'd sat in this damn submarine for 36 hours, I think it was, and the air got so foul that when they took in oxygen, they were sick, but they took the oxygen after they'd got in and put these things on, got into the escape hatch, switched on the oxygen, and were sick. Now they have to take the oxygen and get used to it, and if there's any sickness, that's it, and you then get in, as you learnt that at least. So the old boy came out of that with flying colours because the answer was such a simple one. He was that type of person. What appeared to be a very serious problem, he could very quickly turn over. And it didn't matter what he took up in science, he was right at the top immediately. He was a biologist, really. But atomic science, oh, he had it all taped off.
What sort of relationship did he have with Charlotte? They sound like rather different.
Oh, yes, he didn't. It was a free and easy one. You do what you like, I'll do we've had all. They had a son who went out and they brought him back. But they were two very good people, you know. Very good people. Charlotte did a lot for the game.
So you only did that for a short time, actually?
Yes, I...
Fundraising.
Yes, I came out and I went. I spent most of the time going around the country holding meetings trying to raise money. But it was the old party business. You'd get a collection at a big meeting. I mean, if you got £150, that was a colossal collection. And the pennies and shillings that were coming in through the Daily Worker, I mean, if we picked up £50 a week, we were doing well. Well, that was pin money. So I had a meeting with Harry and said, look, Harry, you've got to take this out of the party. This is too big for the party. After all, we had hundreds of fellows, you know, who were wounded, no leg, one leg off, one arm.